No. Bram already has too many citations from the care center. The train swooshed to a stop, and in that moment, I knew what I had to do. I picked up his school bag and held it out to him. "It's up to you," I said, looking right into his eyes and holding his gaze. "You can grow up, or you can be a baby." Bram looked hurt. I shoved the bag into his arms and whispered into his ear, "I know a way to play games on the scribe."
"Really?"
I nodded. Bram's face lit up. He took the bag and went through the air train doors without a backward glance. My parents and I climbed on after him, and my mother hugged me tight once we were inside.
"Thank you," she said.
There weren't any games on the scribe, of course. I had to invent some, but I'm not a natural sorter for nothing. It took Bram months to figure out that none of the other kids had older siblings who hid patterns and pictures in screens full of letters and then timed them to see how fast they could find them all. That was why I knew before anyone else that Bram would never be a sorter. But I still invented levels and records of achievement and spent almost all my free time during those months coming up with games I thought he would like. And even when he figured it out, he wasn't mad. We'd had too much fun, and after all, I hadn't lied. I had known a way to play games on the scribe.
"That was the day,"
Kai says now, and stops. "What?"
"The day I knew about you."
"Why?" I say, feeling hurt somehow. "Because you could see I followed the rules? That I made my brother follow them too?"
"No,"
he says, as if it should be obvious.
"Because I saw the way you cared about your brother, and because I saw that you were smart enough to save him."
Then he smiles at me.
"I already knew what you looked like, but that day was when I first knew about you."
"Oh," I say.
"What about me?"
he asks. "What do you mean?"
"When did you first see me?"
For some reason, I can't tell him. I can't tell him that it was his face on the screen the morning after my match banquet, the mistake, that made me first think of him this way. I can't tell him that I didn't see him until they told me to look. "On the top of the first hill," I say instead. And I wish that I did not have to tell him this lie, when he knows more of my truth than anyone else in the world. Later that night, I realized that Kai did not give me any more of his story, and I did not ask. Perhaps it is because now I live in his story. Now I am a part of his, and he of mine, and the part we write together sometimes feels like the only part that matters. But still, the question haunts me. What happened when the officials took him away, when the sun was red and low in the sky? Chapter 25. Our time together feels like a storm, like wild wind and rain, like something too big to handle but too powerful to escape. It blows around me and tangles my hair, leaves water on my face, makes me know that I am alive, alive, alive. There are moments of calm and pause, as there are in every storm, and moments when our words fork lightning, at least for each other. We hurry up the hill together, touching hands, touching trees, talking. Kai has things to tell me, and I have things to tell him, and there is not enough time. Not enough time. Never enough time.
"There are people who call themselves archivists," Kai says. "Back when the 100 committee made their selections, the archivists knew the works that didn't get selected would become a commodity. So they saved some of them. The archivists have illegal ports, ones they've built themselves, for storing things. They saved the Thomas poem I brought you."
"I had no idea," I say, touched. I never thought that someone might think far enough ahead to save some of the poems. Did Grandfather know this? It doesn't seem like he did. He never gave them his poems to save. Kai puts his hand on my arm.
"Kasia, the archivists aren't altruistic. They saw a commodity and they did what they could to preserve it. Anyone can have it who's willing to pay, but their prices are high. He stops as though he's revealed too much, that this poem cost him something. What did you trade with them? I ask, suddenly afraid. As far as I know, Kai has two things of value, his artifact and the words of the Do Not Go Gentle poem. I don't want him to give up the artifact, his last tie to his family, and for some reason, the thought of our poem being traded repulses me. Selfishly, I don't want just anyone to have it. I realize that I'm not much better than the officials in this regard.
Something, he says, and his eyes are amused. Don't worry about the price.
Your artifact?
Don't worry. I didn't trade that. I didn't trade our poem either. But Kasia, if you ever need to, they don't know about the poem. I asked how many Dylan Thomas writings they had, and they didn't have much. The birthday poem and a story. That was all.
If I ever need to what?
Trade,
he says carefully.
Trade for something else. The archivists have information, connections. You could tell them one of the poems your grandfather gave you.
He frowns.
Although proving authenticity might be a problem, since you don't have the original paper. Still, I'm sure they would be worth something.
I'd be too afraid to trade with people like that, I say. And then I wish I hadn't. I don't want Kai to think I get scared easily.
They're not completely evil, he says. I'm trying to get you to see that they're no better or worse than anyone else. No better or worse than the officials. You have to be careful with the archivists, the same way you have to be careful with everyone else.
Where would I find them? I ask him, frightened by his need to let me know this. What does he think is going to happen? Why does he think I might need to know how to sell our poem?
The museum,
he tells me.
Go to the basement and stand in front of the exhibit about the glorious history of Oria Province. No one ever goes there. If you stay long enough, someone will ask you if you want them to tell you more about the history. You say yes. They'll know you want contact with an archivist.
How do you know this? I ask him, surprised again at all the ways he knows how to survive. He shakes his head.
It's better if I don't tell you.
What if someone goes there who really does want to know more about the history? Kai laughs.
No one ever does, Kasia. No one here wants to know anything about the past.
We hurry on, hands still touching through the branches. I hear Kai humming a piece of one of the 100 songs, the one we heard together. I love that one, I say, and he nods. The woman who sings it has such a beautiful voice.
If only it were real,
he says. What do you mean? I ask him. He looks at me, surprised.
Her voice. She's not real. It's generated. The perfect voice. Like all the singers of all the songs. Didn't you know that?
I shake my head, disbelieving. That can't be right. When she's singing, I can hear her breathe.
That's part of it,
Kai says, his eyes distant, remembering something.
They know that we like to feel that things are authentic. We like to hear them breathe.
How do you know?
I've heard real people singing,
he says. So have I, at school, and my father sang to me.
I mean, singing out, as loud as you can, whenever you felt like it. I've heard people sing like that, but not here. And even the most beautiful voice in the world didn't sound anywhere near as perfect as that voice in the music hall.
For a split second, I imagine him at home in that landscape he has drawn for me, listening to others sing. Kai glances up at the sun blinking through the trees above us. He's gauging the time. He trusts the sun more than his watch. I've noticed this. As he stands there shielding his eyes with one hand, another line from the Thomas poem comes to mind. Wild men who caught and sang the sun in flight. I would like to hear Kai sing. Kai reaches into his pocket, pulls out the other Thomas poem, my birthday one.
Do you know it well enough yet?
I know what he's saying,
It's time to destroy the poem. It's dangerous to keep it for too long. Yes, I say, but let me look at it one more time. I read it over and look back up at Kai. It's not as sad to destroy this one, I say, telling him and reminding myself. Other people know it. He nods at me. Do you want me to take it home and incinerate it? I ask.
I thought we could leave it here, he says. Bury it in the ground.
I'm reminded of planting with Xander, but this poem has nothing tied to it. It's severed, neat and clean, from where it came. We know the name of the author. We don't know anything about him. Don't know what he wanted the poem to mean, what he thought when he formed the words, how he wrote it. That long ago, were there scribes? I can't remember from the 100 history lessons. Or did he write it as Kai writes, with his hands? Did the poet know how lucky he was to have such beautiful words and a place to put them and keep them? Kai reaches for the poem. Wait, I say. Let's not bury all of it. I hold out my hand for the paper, and he puts it in my hand, smoothing it flat over my palm. There's not much to it. It's small, one verse. It will be easily buried. I tear carefully along the line that talks about the birds. Birds and the birds of the winged trees flying my name. I tear it smaller, smaller, until the pieces are tiny and light. Then I toss them into the breeze to let them fly for a moment. They are so small that I don't see where most of them settle, but one lands soft on a branch near me. Perhaps a real bird will use it for a nest, will tuck it away from everyone else, as I have the other Thomas poem. We do know about the author, I realize, as Kai and I bury the rest of the paper. We know him through his words. And someday I will have to share the poems. I know it. And someday I will have to tell Xander what is happening here on the hill. But not yet. I burned poetry before to be safe. I can't do it now. I hold the poetry of our moments together, tight, protecting them, protecting us, all of us.
Tell me about your match banquet,
Kai says another time. He wants me to tell him about Xander?
Not about Xander,
he says, reading my mind and smiling that smile I love. Even now when he smiles more often, I am still greedy for it. Sometimes I reach out and touch his lips with my hand when he does it. I do that now, feel them move as he says,
about you.
I was nervous, excited. I stop.
What did you think about?
I wish I could tell him that I thought about him, but I lied to him once and I won't do it again. And besides, I wasn't thinking about Xander either. I thought about angels, I say.
Angels?
You know, the ones in the old stories, how they can fly to heaven.
Do you think anyone believes in them anymore?
He asks. I don't know. No? Do you?
I believe in you,
he says, his voice hushed and almost reverent.
That's more faith than I ever thought I'd have.
We move quickly through the trees. I feel, more than see, that we must be nearing the top of the hill. Eventually, our work here will be done, and this time will be over. It doesn't take long anymore to traverse the first part of the hill. Everything is tamped down and well marked, and we know where we are going, at least initially. But there is still unexplored territory left. There are still things to discover. For that, I am grateful. I'm so grateful that I wish I did believe in angels so that I could express my gratitude to someone or something.
Tell me more,
Kai says. I wore a green dress.
Green,
he says, glancing back at me.
I've never seen you in green.
You've never seen me in anything but brown or black, I tell him. Brown plain clothes, black swimwear. I flush.
I take back what I said,
he says later, as the whistle blows.
I have seen you in green. I see you in green every day, here in the trees.
The next day, I ask him, "Can you tell me why you cried in the showing that day?"
"You saw me?"
I nod.
"I couldn't help it."
His gaze is distant, hard now.
"I didn't know they had footage like that. It could have been my village. It was definitely one of the outer provinces."
"Wait." I think of the people, dark shadows running. "You're saying this was...
real?"
he finished.
"Yes. Those aren't actors. It's not a stage. It happens in all the outer provinces, Kasia. When I left, it was happening more and more."
"Oh, no." The whistle will blow soon, I can tell. He knows, too. But I reach for him and hold on here in the forest where the trees screen us and the bird calls cover our voices. The whole hill is complicit in our embrace. I pull away first because I have something to write before our time ends. I've been practicing in air, but I want to carve in earth. "Close your eyes," I say to Kai, and I bend down. He's breathing above me while he waits. "There," I say, and he looks at what I've written. "I love you." I feel embarrassed, as though I am a child who has tapped out these words on her scribe and held them out for a boy in her first school class to read. My writing is awkward and straggly, and not smooth like Kai's. Why are some things easier to write than say? Still, I feel undeniably brave and vulnerable as I stand there in the forest with words that I cannot take back. My first written words, other than our names. It's not much of a poem, but I think Grandfather would understand. Kai looks at me. For the first time since the showing, I see tears in his eyes. "You don't have to write it back," I say, feeling self-conscious. "I just wanted you to know."
"I don't want to write it back,"
he tells me. And then he says it, right out there on the hill. "And of all the words I have hidden and saved and treasured, these are the ones I will never forget, the most important ones of all."
"I love you."
Lightning. Once it has forked, hot white, from sky to earth, there is no going back. It's time. I feel it. I know it. My eyes on him, his on me, and both of us breathing, watching, tired of waiting. Kai closes his eyes, but mine are still open. What will it feel like, his lips on mine, like a secret told, a promise kept, like that line in the poem, "A shower of all my days, silvery rain falling all around me, where the lightning meets the earth"? The whistle blows below us, and the moment breaks. We are safe. For now. Chapter 26. We hurry back down from the hill. I see glimpses of white through the trees, and I know they are not the birds we saw earlier. These white figures aren't made for flight. "Officials," I say to Kai, and he nods. We report to the officer, who looks a bit preoccupied with the visitors waiting for us. I wonder again how he ended up with this assignment. Even supervising the marking of the big hill seems like a waste of time for someone of his rank. As I turn away, I see all the lines that discipline has etched in his face, and I realize again that he is not very young. The officials, I discover when I get closer, are ones I've seen before. The ones who tested my sorting abilities. The blonde female official takes charge this time. Apparently, this is her portion of the test to administer. "Hello, Kasia," she says. "We're here to take you on your on-site portion of the sorting test. Can you come with us now?" She glances over at the officer with a touch of deference in her look.
"Go on,"
the officer says, glancing at the others who have returned from the hill.
"You can all go. We'll meet here again tomorrow."
A few of the other hikers look at me with interest, but not concern. Many of us await our final work positions, and officials always seem to be a part of that process.
"We'll take the air train,"
the blonde official says to me.
The test will only last a few hours. You should be home in time for your evening meal.
We walk toward the air train stop, two officials on my right and one on my left. There's no escaping them. I don't dare look back at Kai. Not even when we climb onto the train he takes into the city and I feel, rather than see, him climb into the same car. When he does walk past me, his hello sounds perfect, friendly, unconcerned. He continues on down the length of the car and sits down next to a window. Anyone watching would be convinced that he doesn't feel anything at all for me. He's almost convinced me. We don't get off the air train at the City Hall stop or at any of the other stops in the city proper. We keep going. More and more blue-clothed workers climb on, laughing and talking. One of them cuffs Kai on the shoulder and Kai laughs. I don't see any other officials or anyone else wearing student plain clothes like me. The four of us sit together in the sea of blue, the train twisting and turning like a river running, and I know it's hard to fight against a current as strong as the society. I look out the window and hope with all my heart that this isn't what I think it is, that we aren't going to the same place, that I won't be sorting Kai. Is this a trick? Are they watching us? That's a stupid question, I think to myself. Of course they're watching us. Hulking gray buildings crowd around in this part of town. I see signs, but the air train moves too fast for me to read them. But it's clear where we are. The industrial district. Up ahead, I see Kai shift, stand. He doesn't have to reach up for the grips hanging from the ceiling. He keeps himself level and balanced as the train slides to a stop. For a moment, I think everything will be fine. The officials and I will keep going, past these gray buildings, beyond the airport with its landing strips and bright red traffic flags whipping in the wind like kites, like markers on the hill. We'll go on out to the farmlands, where they'll have me sort nothing more important than a crop or some sheep. Then the officials next to me stand up, and I have no choice but to follow them. Don't panic. I tell myself, look at all these buildings, look at all these workers. You could be sorting anything or anyone. Don't jump to conclusions. Kai doesn't see if I've gotten off too. I study his back and his hands to see if I can find any of the tension running through him that runs through me. But his muscles are relaxed and his stride even as he walks around to the side of the building where the employees enter. Many of the other workers, wearing blue plain clothes, go through the same door. Kai's hands are loose at his sides, open, empty. As Kai disappears into the building, the blonde official leads me around to the front, to a kind of antechamber. The other officials hand her data tags and she places them behind my ear, at my pulse points on my wrists, under the neck of my shirt. She's quick and efficient about it. Now that I'm being monitored, I try even harder to relax. I don't want to seem unusually nervous. I breathe deep and I change the words of the poem. I tell myself to go gentle, just for now. This is the food distribution block of the city, the official informs me. As we mentioned before, the goal of the real-life sort is to see if you can sort real people and situations within certain parameters. We want to see if you can help the government improve function and efficiency. I understand, I say, although I'm not sure I do. Then let's get started. She pushes open the doors and another official comes to greet us. He's apparently the official in charge of this building, and the orange and yellow bars on his shirt mean he's involved in one of the most important departments of all, the nutrition department.
How many do you have today?
He asks, and I realize that I'm not the only one taking the test and completing real-life sorts here. The thought makes me relax a little.
One, she says, but this is our high scorer.
Excellent, he says. Let me know when you finish.
He strides away, and I stand still, overwhelmed by the sights and smells around me, and by the heat. We stand in a gaping space, a chamber larger than the gymnasium at second school. This room looks like a steel box, metal floors dotted with drains, gray-painted concrete walls, and stainless steel appliances lining the sides and bisecting the middle of the room in rows. Steam mists and writhes around the room. Vents at the top and sides of the building open to the outside, but there are no windows. The appliances, the foilware trays, the steaming hot water coming out of the faucets. Everything is gray. A whistle blows, and a new stream of workers comes in from the left while the other workers exit on the right. Their bodies sag, tired, weighted. They all wipe their brows and leave their work without a backward glance.
The new workers have been in a sterilization chamber to remove all outside contaminants, the official tells me conversationally. That's where they pick up their numbers and adhere them to their uniforms. This new shift is the one you'll be concerned with.
She gestures up, and I notice several outlook points throughout the room. Small metal towers with officials standing at the top. There are three towers. The one in the middle of the floor is empty.
We'll be up there.
I follow her up the metal stairs, the kind that we have at air train stops. But these stairs end on a small platform with barely enough space for the four of us to stand. Already, the gray-haired official perspires heavily and his face is red. My hair sticks to the back of my neck. And all we have to do is stand and watch. We don't even have to work. I knew Kai's job was hard, but I had no idea. Tubs and tubs of dirty containers stand next to small stations with sinks and recycling tubes. Through a large opening at the end of the building, the soiled foilware arrives in a never-ending stream, flowing from the recycling bins in our residences and meal halls. The workers wear clear protective gloves, but I don't see how the plastic or latex doesn't melt into their skin as they spray off the foilware containers with hot water. Then they put the clean foilware down into the recycling tubes. It goes on and on and on, a steady flow of steam and scalding water and foilware. My mind threatens to glaze over and shut down as it does when I'm confronted with a particularly difficult sort on the screen, and I feel overwhelmed. But these aren't numbers on the screen. These are people. This is Kai. So I force myself to stay clear and focused. I force myself to watch those bent backs and those burning hands and the vastness of all the refuse sliding silver along the tracks. One of the workers raises his hand, and an official comes down from his perch to confer with the worker. He gives a foilware container to the official, who scans the barcode on the side of the container with his data pod. After a moment, he takes the foilware container with him and disappears into an office at the edge of the large open room. The worker is already back at work. The official looks at me as if she's waiting for something.
What do you think?
She asks. I'm not sure what she wants, so I hedge. Of course, the most efficient thing to do would be to get machines.
That is not an option, the official says pleasantly. Food preparation and distribution needs to be handled by personnel, live personnel. It's a rule. But we would like to free up more of the workers for other projects and vocations.
I don't see how to make it any more efficient, I say. There's the other obvious answer, to make them work more hours, but they look exhausted as it is. My voice trails off, a wisp of steam too small to matter.
We're not asking you to come up with a solution, the official sounds amused. Those who are higher up than you have already done that. Hours will be extended, leisure hours will cease, then some of the personnel from this area can be spared for another vocation.
I'm beginning to understand, and I wish I weren't. So if you don't want me to sort the other variables in the work situation, you want me to...
Sort the people, she says.
I feel sick. She holds out a data pod.
You have 3 hours to watch. Enter the number of the workers you think are the most efficient,
those who should be sent to work on an alternative project. I look at the numbers on the back of the workers' shirts. This is like a sort on the screen. I'm supposed to watch for the faster patterns among the workers. They want to see if my mind will automatically register the workers who move the most quickly. Computers could do this job, and probably have. But now they want to see if I can do it, too.
And Kasia?
The official says from the metal stairs. I look down at her.
Your decisions will hold. That's part of the test. We want to see if you can make decisions well when you know they have actual results.
She sees the shock on my face and continues. I can tell she's trying to be kind.
It's one shift of one group of menial laborers, Kasia. Don't worry. Just do your best.
But what's the other project? Will they have to leave the city? The official looks shocked.
We can't answer that. It's not relevant to the sort.
The gray-haired official, still breathing heavily from his ascent, turns back to see what's happening. She nods to him that she's on her way down and then tells me gently,
Better workers get the better work positions, Kasia. That's all you need to know.
I don't want to do this. For a moment, I contemplate throwing the data pod into one of the sinks, letting it drown. What would Kai do if he were the one standing up here? I don't throw the data pod. I take deep breaths. Sweat runs down my back and a piece of my hair falls into my eyes. I push the hair back with one hand and then I straighten my shoulders to look at the workers. My eyes dart from place to place. I try not to see faces, only numbers. I look for fast patterns and slow ones. I start to sort. The most disturbing part of the whole experience is that I am very, very good at it. Once I tell myself to do what Kai would do, I don't look back. Over the course of the sort, I watch for pacing and patterns, and I watch for stamina. I see the slower, more steady ones who get more done than you might think. I see the quick, deft ones who are the very best. I see the ones who can't quite keep up. I see their red hands move amid the steam, and I see the pile of foilware moving along in its silver stream as it turns from dirty to clean. But I don't see people. I don't see faces. When the 3 hours are almost over, my sort is complete, and I know it's a good one. I know I've classified the best workers in the group by their numbers. But I can't resist. I look at the number of the very middle worker, the one who is right in between the best and the worst of the group. I look up. It's the number on Kai's back. I want to laugh and cry. It's as though he's sending me a message. No one fits in the way he does. No one else has mastered the art of being exactly average so well. For a few seconds, I let myself watch the boy in blue plain clothes with the dark hair. My instincts tell me to put him with the more efficient group. I know that's where he belongs. That's the group that gets the new vocation. They might have to leave the city, but at least he wouldn't be trapped here forever. Still, I don't think I could do it. What would my life be like if he left? I let myself imagine climbing down from that ladder and pulling Kai close in the middle of all this heat and sound. And then I imagine something even better. I imagine walking over and taking his hand and leading him out of this place into light and air. I could do this. If I sort him into the higher group, he won't have to work here anymore. His life will be better. I could be the one to change that for him, and suddenly that desire, the desire to help him, is even stronger than my selfish desire to keep him close. But I think of the boy in the story he's given me, the boy who has done everything he can to survive. What would that boy's instincts say? He would want me to put him in the lower group.
Almost finished, the official asks me.
She waits on the metal steps a few paces below. I nod. She climbs toward me, and I pull up another number of someone who is near the middle so that she doesn't know I've been looking at Kai. She stands next to me, looking at the number and then out at the person on the floor. The middle workers are always the hardest to sort, she says with sympathy in her voice. It's hard to know what to do. I nod, but she's not finished.
Menial laborers like these don't usually live to 80, she says.
Her voice hushes.
Many of them are aberration status, you know. The society doesn't worry as much about them reaching optimal age. Many die early. Not horribly early, of course. Not pre-society early or outer province early, but 60, 70. Lower-level vocations in nutrition disposal are particularly dangerous, even with all the precautions we take.
But the shock on my face doesn't surprise her, and I realize that this must be part of the test, too. Coming across an unknown factor in the middle of an otherwise straightforward sort just when you thought you were done. And I wonder, what's going on here? Why are the stakes so high for a test sort? There's something happening that is something bigger than me, bigger than Kai.
This is all confidential information, of course, the official says.
Then she glances down at her data pod.
You have 2 minutes.
I need to concentrate, but my mind is off on another sort of its own, asking questions and lining them up to make an answer. Why do the laborers die early? Why couldn't grandfather share the food from his plate at the final banquet? Why do so many aberrations work in food cleanup? They poison the food for the elderly. It's all clear now. Our society prides itself on never killing anyone, having done away with the death penalty. But what I see here and what I've heard about the outer provinces tells me that they have found another way to take care of things. The strong survive. Natural selection. With help from our gods, of course. The officials. If I get to play God or angel, then I have to do the best I can for Kai. I can't let him die early, and I can't let him spend his life in this room. There has to be something better out there for him. I have enough faith left in my society to think that. I have seen many people living good lives, and I want one of those lives to be Kai's, whether or not I can be a part of it. I sort Kai into the higher group, and close the data pod as if the decision has cost me nothing at all. Inside, I scream. I hope I made the right choice. Tell me more about where you're from, I say to Kai on the hill the next day, hoping he doesn't hear the desperation in my voice, hoping he doesn't ask about the sort. I have to know more about his story. I have to know if I did the right thing. The sort has changed things between us. We feel watched, even here in the trees. We speak softly. We don't look at each other too long.
It's red and orange there. Colors you don't see here very often.
That's true, I say. And I try to think of the things that are red. Some of the dresses at the match banquet. The fires and the incinerators. Blood.
Why is there so much green and brown and blue here?
He asks me. Maybe because they are growing colors and so much of our province is agricultural, I say. You know, how blue is the color of water and brown the color of fall and harvest, and green is the color of spring?
People always say that,
Kai says.
But red is the first color of spring. It's the real color of rebirth.
He's right, I realize. I think of the ruddy color of the tight new buds on the trees, of the red of his hands the day before in the nutrition disposal center, and the new beginning I hope I have given him. Chapter 27.
Warning! Warning!
The light on the tracker flashes, and words scroll across the screen.
You have reached maximum speed earlier than recommended for this exercise session.
I punch the numbers so that I go even faster.
Warning, Warning! You have exceeded your optimal heart rate.
Usually, when I push too hard on the tracker, I stop in time. I take things to the edge, but I never jump. But if I go to the edge enough times, I'm going to get pushed over or fall right in. Maybe it's time to jump. But I can't do it without dragging all the people I love with me.
Warning! Warning!
I'm going too fast. I'm too tired. I know it, but my fall still surprises me. My foot slips on the tracker, and before I know it, I'm down. Down on the tracker with the belt still going and burning, burning, burning my skin. I lie there for a moment, in shock and on fire, and then I roll off as fast as I can. The tracker keeps going, but it will notice my absence in a moment. It will stop, and then they will know I couldn't keep up. But if I get back on fast enough, no one has to know what happened. I glance at my skin, rubbed raw and red from the moving belt. Red. I jump up, I tense my muscles and spring at just the right time, and I hit the tracker running. Pound, 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 pound. My knees and elbow stream blood, and I have tears in my eyes, but I am still going. The plain clothes will hide my scars tomorrow, and no one will ever know that I fell. No one will ever know what happened until it is too late. When I come back upstairs after running on the tracker, my father gestures me toward the port.
Just in time, he says. There's a communication for you.
The sorting officials wait on the screen.
Your sort looks excellent,
the blonde official tells me.
Congratulations on passing the test. I'm sure you'll hear news regarding your work position soon.
I nod my head, sweat dripping off me and blood from my cuts running down my knees and my arms. She can only see the sweat, I think to myself. I tug my sleeves down a little to make sure they cover everything, so that no one will know that I am injured and bloody. Thank you. I look forward to it. I step back, sure that the port screen communication is finished, but the official has one last question for me.
Are you sure that there aren't any changes you want to make before the sort is implemented?
My last chance to take back what I've done. I almost say it. I have his number memorized. It would be so easy. Then I remember what she told me about life expectancy, and the words turn to rocks in my mouth, and I can't speak around them.
Kasia?
I'm sure. I turn away from the port and almost run into my father.
Congratulations, he says. Sorry. I hope you don't mind that I listened. They didn't say it was a private communication.
It's fine, I say. Then I ask, did you ever wonder... I pause, unsure of how to phrase this. How to ask him if he ever doubted his match with my mother. If he ever wanted someone else.
Did I ever wonder what?
He asks me. Never mind, I say, because I think I already know the answer. Of course he didn't. They fell in love immediately and never looked back. I go into my room and open my closet. Once it held the compact and the poem. Now it is empty except for plain clothes and shoes and the small framed piece of my dress. I don't know where my silver box is, and I panic. Did they accidentally take it when they took the artifacts? No, of course not. They know what the silver boxes are. They'd never mistake them for something from the past. The match banquet boxes are clearly for the future. I'm hunting around through my meager belongings when my mother comes into the room. She returned late last night from her third trip out of Oria.
Are you looking for something? She asks.
I straighten up. I found it, I say, holding up the fragment of green under glass. I don't want to tell her that I can't find the match banquet box. She takes the square of glass from me and holds it up, the green fabric from the dress catching the light.
Did you know that there used to be windows with colored glass? She asks. People put them in places where they worshipped, or in their own homes.
Stained glass, I say. Papa's told me about it. It does sound beautiful. Light shining through color. Windows as art or tribute.
Of course he has, she says, laughing at herself.
I finally submitted that report today, and now I'm so tired I can't think well. Is everything all right? I ask. I want to ask her what she meant about the trees that day, why she thought their loss was a warning to her, but I don't think I want to know. After the real-life sort, I feel like I can't take any more pressure. I feel as though I already know too much. Besides, my mother seems happier now than she seemed in weeks, and I don't want to change that.
I think it will be, she says.
Oh, good, I say. We're both silent for a moment, looking at my dress under glass. Are you going to have to travel again?
No, I don't think so, she says. I think that's finished. I hope.
She still looks exhausted, but I can see that submitting the report has lifted a burden. I take the memento back from her, and as I do, I have an idea. Can I see the piece of your dress? The last time I looked at it was the night before my match banquet. I was a little nervous, and she brought me the dress fragment and told me again the story of their match with its happy ending. But so much has changed since then. I wonder if her dress will look different to me now. Of course, she says, and I follow her into her bedroom. The framed bit of fabric sits on a little shelf inside the closet she shares with my father, along with two silver boxes, hers and my father's, that held their microcards, and later, the rings for their contract. The rings are purely ceremonial, of course. They don't get to keep them, and they give the microcards back to the officials at the contract celebration. So my parents' silver boxes are empty. I pick up her dress fragment and hold it up. My mother's gown was blue, and thanks to preservation techniques, the satin is still bright and lovely in its frame. I put it next to mine along the windowsill. Together, side by side, I imagine that they look a little like a stained glass window. The light behind them brightens them, and I can almost imagine that I could look through the colors and see a world made beautiful and different. My mother understands.
Yes, she says. I imagine the windows looked something like that.
I want to tell her everything, but I can't. Not now. I am too fragile. I am trapped in glass, and I want to break out and breathe deep, but I'm too afraid that it will hurt. My mother puts her arm around me.
Can you tell me what's wrong?
She asks gently.
Is it something to do with your match?
I reach for my dress fragment and take it down from the window so my mother sits up there alone. I don't trust myself to speak, so I shake my head. No. How can I explain to my perfectly matched mother everything that has happened, everything I've risked? How can I explain to her that I'd do it again? How can I tell her that I hate the system that created her life, her love, her family, that created me? Instead, I ask, "How did you know?" She reaches for her frame and takes it down, too.
At first, I could see that you were falling deeper and deeper in love. But I didn't worry about it, because I thought your match was perfect for you. Xander is wonderful, and you might be able to stay in Oria, nearby, since both of your families live here. As a mother, I couldn't imagine a better scenario.
She pauses, looking at me.
And then I was so busy with work, it took until today for me to realize that I was wrong. You weren't thinking of Xander.
Don't say it, I beg her with my eyes. Don't say that you know I'm in love with someone else, please.
Kasia,
she tells me, and the love in her eyes for me is pure and true, and that's what makes her next words cut deep. Because I know she has my best interests at heart.
I'm married to someone wonderful. I have two beautiful children and a job I love. It's a good life.
She holds out the piece of blue satin.
Do you know what would happen if I broke this glass?
I nod. The cloth would disintegrate. It would be ruined.
Yes, she says.
And then it's almost as if she's speaking to herself.
It would be ruined. Everything would be ruined.
Then she puts her hand on my arm.
Do you remember what I said the day they cut the trees down?
Of course I do. About how it was a warning for you?
Yes.
She flushes.
That wasn't true. I was so worried that I wasn't acting rationally. Of course it wasn't a warning for me. It wasn't a warning for anyone. The trees simply needed to come down.
I hear in her voice how badly she wants to believe that what she says is true, how she almost does believe it. Wanting to hear more, but not wanting to push too hard, I ask, "What was so important about the report? What makes it different from other reports you've done?" My mother sighs. She doesn't answer me directly. Instead, she says,
"I don't know how the workers at the medical center stand it when they're working on people or delivering babies. It's too hard to have other lives in your hands."
My unspoken question hovers in the air. "What do you mean?" She pauses. She seems to be deciding whether or not to answer me, and I hold perfectly still until she speaks again. Absent-mindedly, she picks up her dress fragment and begins polishing the glass with the end of her shirt.
"Someone out in Grandia, and then in another province, reported that there were strange crops popping up. The one in Grandia was in the arboretum, in an experimental field that had been fallow for a long time. The other field was in the farmlands of the second province. The government asked me and two others to travel to the fields and submit reports about the crops. They wanted to know two things: were the crops viable as foodstuffs, and were the growers planning a rebellion?"
I draw in my breath. It's forbidden to grow food unless the government has specifically requested it. They control the food. They control us. Some people know how to grow food. Some know how to harvest it. Some know how to process it. Others know how to cook it. But none of us know how to do all of it. We could never survive on our own.
The three of us agreed that the crops were definitely usable as foodstuffs. The grower at the arboretum had an entire field of Queen Anne's lace.
My mother's face changes suddenly, lights up.
"Oh, Kasia, it was so beautiful. I've only seen a sprig here and there. This was a whole field waving in the wind."
"Wild carrot," I say, remembering.
"Wild carrot,"
she agrees, her voice sad.
"The second grower had a crop I'd never seen before, of white flowers even more beautiful than the first. Sego lilies, they called them. One of the others with me knew what they were. You can eat the bulb. Both growers denied knowing you could use the plants for food. They both asserted that their interest was in the flower. They insisted the plants were new to them and that they cultivated them as research for the blossoms."
Her voice, which has been soft and sad since she mentioned the field of Queen Anne's lace, grows stronger.
"The three of us argued the whole way back after the second trip. One expert was convinced the growers were telling the truth. The other thought they were lying. They submitted conflicting reports. Everyone waited for mine. I asked for one last trip to be sure. After all, these growers will be relocated or sent on a work detail based on our reports. Mine would tip the balance one way or the other."
She stops polishing the glass and looks down at the piece of blue cloth as though there is something written there for her to see. And I realize that for her, there is. That blue cloth represents the night she was matched to my father. She reads her life, the life she loves, in that square of blue satin.
"I knew all along," she whispers. "I knew when I saw the fear in their eyes when we first arrived.
They knew what they were doing, and something the Queen Anne's lace grower said on my second visit convinced me even more of the truth. He acted as though he'd never even seen the plant outside of a port screen before, but he grew up in a town near mine, and I knew I'd seen the flower there growing wild. But I still hesitated. And then, when I came home again and saw all of you, I realized I had to report the truth. I had to fulfill my duty to the society and guarantee our happiness and keep us all safe. That last word, safe, is as soft and hushed as the swish of silk. I understand, I tell her, and I do, and the hold she has over me is much greater than the officials because I love her and admire her. Back in my room, I find the silver box where it fell inside one of my winter boots. I open it up and take out the microcard with all of Xander's information and the courtship guidelines. If there hadn't been a mistake, if I'd just seen his face and everything had been normal, none of this would have happened. I wouldn't have fallen in love with Kai, and the choice wouldn't have been so hard to make in the sort. Everything would have been fine. Everything can still be fine. If the sort is what I suspect, if Kai leaves for a better life, will I pick up the pieces of my life here? The biggest piece, my match with Xander, would not be hard to shape a life around. I could love him. I do love him, and because I do, I have to tell him about Kai. I do not mind stealing from the society, but I will not steal from Xander any longer. Even if it hurts, I have to tell him. Because either way, whichever life I build has to be built on truth. Thinking of telling Xander hurts almost as much as thinking of losing Kai. I roll over and hold the tablet container tight in my palm. Think of something else. I remember the first time I saw Kai on top of that little hill, leaning back, wind in his face, and I realized that is when I fell in love with him. I didn't lie to him after all. I didn't see him differently because I saw his face on the port screen the morning after my match. I saw him differently because I saw him outside. Unguarded for a moment, with eyes the color of the sky in the evening before it goes down into dark. I saw him seeing me. Lying in bed, my body and soul bruised and tired, I realized that the officials are right. Once you want something, everything changes. Now I want everything. More and more and more, I want to pick my work position, marry who I choose, eat pie for breakfast and run down a real street instead of on a tracker. Go fast when I want and slow when I want. Decide which poems I want to read and what words I want to write. There is so much that I want. I feel it so much that I am water, a river of want, pooled in the shape of a girl named Kasha. Most of all, I want Kai.
We're running out of time, Kai says.
I know. I've been counting the days, too. Even if Kai's new work position is still here in the city, the summer leisure activities are almost over. I won't see Kai nearly as much. I allow myself to daydream for a few seconds. What if his new position is one that allows him more time? He could come to all of the Saturday night activities. Only a couple of weeks of hiking left.
That's not what I mean, he says, moving closer.